A warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 682 to 719 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text, published by Little Brown and Company. Two announcements before we get started. The first is that if you haven't signed up for Patreon and you're able to give $2 a month to the show, it'd be awesome to have you on there. We have a lot of benefits now. I just sort of went ham and just started adding benefits for even the $2 patrons. So now we're making the postcard thing permanent because I enjoyed it personally so much, handwriting something to thank my audience. It's just amazing to be able to do something physical and personal and send that to the person. So if you want a personalized postcard, there's also going to be behind the scenes posts about DH and I, how I make episodes, where I outsource editing from when I need to, etc., etc. There's going to be a monthly live stream for some of our tiers. It's just going to be an amazing little curated community that I've been really enjoying thus far making content for. So if you want a part of that, go to patreon.com/relevanceofliterature. You can find all the info you need there. Also, vocab will be updated by the end of July. That's my goal. And I think we're going to be done with a big part of the book by the end of July as well. So for me, that's my goal in terms of updating vocab on our website. I expect, honestly, that people who start listening to the podcasts retrospectively or are behind in the novel at this point are the ones that are using the vocab section the most, but it is something, and I'm also compiling just a document of all the sources that we've used in general on the show, but those two things are something that I really think we will find impactful if we decide to reread the book, do like a 1 month challenge or something with this book, or also people who are joining the show a little bit later or maybe a couple years from now and want to just have everything in one place. So starting off here on page 682, this is the 14th of November, YDAU. I actually love this frame. This is one of my favorite frames in the whole book though thus far. I don't know what it is. I think maybe we're finally progressing in time, so that gets me excited. The tone and the interconnectedness of this whole section in general, I find really intriguing as well. We'll get more into that in a minute. But here we meet Maddie Pemulis, Pemulis's older brother, Michael Pemulis's older brother, and he is a neat eater. He's 23 years old and he's a prostitute. We meet him for the first time in a restaurant. It seems like an ethnic restaurant. And we hear this heartbreaking story. I thought it was heartbreaking, but it's a heartbreaking story about his da, who is an immigrant from Ireland to the States, and how his da sexually abused him starting from age 10. And Maddie, or the narrator by way of Maddie, walks us through a couple of these traumatizing scenes as he's growing up and his da is coming into his room late at night and abusing him. This may have something to do maybe with his position as a prostitute, or if he's into drugs, and it seems like Michael Pemulis is also pretty much into drugs, into that whole lifestyle, so maybe part of this abuse went towards that lifestyle. We don't know yet. Footnote 278, though, is DFW or the narrator, whomever is writing retrospectively here. The question that the footnote 278 here asks is, where is Mrs. Pemulis? That's what I want to know, too, because she was married to him, she was there the whole time, but where the heck was she when this guy was abusing this 10-year-old? That's just such a pressing question. We learn later in this section that Daw has died from a pancreatic episode of some kind. There was blood involved, and Maddie was standing right there with him. And again, as I said just a few moments ago, the whole section this time, this whole 40 pages, is highly interconnected in a way we haven't seen before in this novel. And the first indication of all of that is that poor Tony Krause shows up outside the window of the place where Maddie is eating. He's post-seizure at this point, so we know he's survived, and He is outside on the sidewalk. Maddie, at this point, notices a pair of girls in the restaurant, which he describes as interracial. We're going to get into the problematic, or I think problematic, nature of that in a minute. But Maddie notices this pair of girls that's going to be important for later in this thread. Next up, 11th of November, MyDAU, page 686. We learn that Hal is depressed and he's experiencing detachment, and the depression and detachment are highly linked. We'll talk about that in later in the novel. And then also there's some withdrawal symptoms from weed, and we learn something crucial, which is that he has had weed every single day for a year, like literally weed every single 24-hour period for a year, and so he's probably experiencing some pretty serious withdrawal symptoms. It seems like not only is he addicted to the secrecy of it all, but he's also addicted, in part at least, to the substance. In this thread, he's trying to talk to rather Shtit, and he runs into DeLint instead, which is a highly unsatisfactory encounter for him. DeLint says something that's really, it really bothers Hal. He says, quote, "You just never quite occurred out there, kid," DeLint apprises him. I just, man, it's just, that's harsh. And that's something, so, I'm a music kid. I started trying to do a lot of professional like music when I was really young. And I see a lot of parallels between music and professional tennis, as I've mentioned in other episodes, especially last week. And man, adults would say that kind of thing to me as a musician. They would say, a horrible piece of advice, first of all, if you can imagine yourself doing anything but music, don't pursue music. That's a horrible piece of advice. One, because when you're 11, you have no idea what you want to do. You can say you've decided, but you haven't really decided until you know all the information. Number two, if you can't imagine yourself doing anything but music, really, what happens when you get an injury and you can't pursue music anymore? That's a really destructive way of thinking for some people. And so for me, I had always imagined myself doing many things besides music. I was a kid who was interested in everything. Literature was obviously one thing that I really took with and ran, or took and ran with, but yeah, that again, adults would say that kind of stuff to me, and that hit me really hard when DeLint said that to Hal, because I felt Hal in that moment. That was one of those really relatable parts of the book for me. We also learned that the Steeply Potron Court conversation is pretty conspicuous. And I expected this, obviously. It's in Quebecois French, and it's this a very manly woman journalist, and she's trying to meet Hal in person and talk to him, and she's pretty assertive about it. But yeah, that conversation was conspicuous, and we absolutely know that now. We also, in this thread, watch Hal as he gets himself into a viewing room and he starts putting on Dr. Incandenza's films. He starts watching them, just one after the other. We're going to talk about some of his films in this thread. And one thing that I noticed that I'm not sure is completely correct time-wise, but I think it's a pretty accurate observation, is that the time period that he started consuming weed, so a year plus ago, definitely coincides, I think, at least from my memory, with his massive tennis upheaval, his massive tennis improvement. And so it may be like a story I heard from David Sedaris a while ago, which is that David Sedaris only wrote when he drunk. And so for the longest time, he didn't think he could write without drinking. And when he quit drinking, it was a really hard transition for him to start writing again without it. And I think maybe something similar may be happening with Hal. I'm not sure how the addiction withdrawal thing works into all of this, but that was one connection that I definitely saw while I was reading this section. Next up, 14th of November, YDAU 689. Here we have poor Tony Krause. He's post-seizure high, and he's in this post-seizure high. He sort of was in the ambulance and then said, "Hey, I'm good," and then left, which is super dangerous, as we all know. And he participated, we see in this section, in something called the Front Center Onanisme, I don't know, group through Bertrand Antichois. We already know the unsettling and hapless fate of the Antichois brothers, Lucien and Bertrand, from earlier sections. They get attacked by the wheelchair assassins. They own a video store. And yeah, apparently Tony Krause was, he dressed up as a decoy with six other people, and there was sort of an assault. It wasn't really an assault, but it was a defacement in some ways of the Canadian Minister of Inter-Onan Trade. And so, yeah, he was a decoy because he was dressed exactly like the assailants, so they all milled around and created pandemonium after this guy was assaulted, and that's where we got the crazy involvement there. And here next is a crazy part where the threads intersect, which is that poor Tony Krause doesn't see what he calls, who he calls, Mad Maddie Pemulis on the way past the restaurant, but he does see the two, quote, interracial girls. Again, we're gonna talk about that in a second. And he decides, in his like really great feeling state, that's only momentary, to purse rob a couple of girls. We know from earlier on there's an article with Helen Steepley, or that Helen Steepley supposedly wrote about a purse snatching, and poor Tony Krause actually stole the woman's heart. So that's one thing where we know, okay, he's a purse snatcher. That's his trade. There's a next little section here that's a tag from Green about Lens getting discharged from Ennett House after the whole Kaitlie incident. I was hoping this would happen just because Lens was breaking all the rules and he was getting away with it, and that sort of infuriated me as a very invested reader in this book. And yeah, and Ewell has apparently taken his place in the three-man room upstairs. So Ewell is one of the intellectual types. We first see him struggling with alcoholism. We know that he is a dwarf, and we know that yeah, he's not someone who just lets his immediate thoughts run wild. He's someone who really thinks and can have a good conversation with people. Also, Green talks about some class differences here and things that he's noticed, because he says that Ewell, Ardetti, and himself, Green, they don't name their units, if you can catch my drift there. I'm not going to get more specific. Whereas the other guys, they have names, some creative, some disturbing for their units, and they are proud to share them with people. Lens is indeed one of them. He calls his unit the Wild Hog. I'm not going to say that again. And yeah, and so what's interesting about this section as well is that we have class differences. We have a lot of commentary on race that I think has been largely put back into this section of the novel. We certainly encountered these kinds of things in other places, but I really think for some reason this section is a sort of catch-all for a lot of these more difficult conversations. We do have these people who were way more well off, like Ewell, Ardetti, Green, somewhat as well. And we get into a lot more people who are well off and also abusing. I think Dr. Incandenza, at least in terms of his economic, socioeconomic circumstances, he was someone who was well off, Joël van Dyne. And Gately nowadays, I think some people maybe wouldn't see him or his very selfless actions and think, wow, he is an ex-drug addict. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. But it is something that I think is really important, especially in terms of our themes of stereotypes and our themes of outward appearances and reading books by their covers kind of themes. We also get another little tag such section about Kay Compert and how she is just not doing well. I have a quote from page 693. quote, Kate Gompertz always thought of this anhedonic state as a kind of radical abstracting of everything, a hollowing out of stuff that used to have effective content. Later on the page, he says that a lot of concepts and themes have a, quote, denotation but not connotation. And I love that quote because I think it really does explain this sort of, the extent of the detachment, where you can talk about things in theory, but it's not really something you empathize with. And that's the state that Kate is in now. I think it's a really great psychological approach to how she might be feeling. As well, we have on page 693 and 694, this is a really cool set of pages. We have another cool set of pages coming up, but this one, I don't know, this set of pages really confuddled me because on 693, we have this pontificating about Dr. Incandenza's death and, you know, about getting the carrot, so to speak, and achieving, and a lot of this a lot of these perspectives are coming from the under 16s at ETA, and they're thinking, oh, they don't necessarily believe Dr. I's and Stitt's philosophy about tennis, where they, Dr. I and Stitt, they say, well, getting the carrot, like achieving your tennis dreams, that you're still going to have discontentment about that. You're still going to have a deeply rooted sense of yearning and failure because of that. So for Dr. I, if he is the narrator, whomever the narrator is, I think if it was Dr. I, it would be very strange for him to be pontificating about the circumstances of him, his own death, and all of these theoretical problems that the under-16s approach his death with. I think it just struck me as very strange if Dr. Incandenza is indeed the narrator. That would be a section where if I was considering the narrator again, I would reread it and think, okay, critically, what does this mean if Dr. Incandenza is the narrator? What kind of narrator would talk about himself posthumously like this? 684, however, is a really... I struggled with the words to describe this section. I settled on parental. It's a very parental view of Hal, and we do get the sense that it's coming from up above. It's a very detached sort of parental view, but I think parental nonetheless. It's very close to Hal almost, and it's talking a lot about Hal's loneliness as well. And I think, I was trying to think, you know, who would care about Hal's loneliness? Does the narrator care about Hal's loneliness? But the narrator does care about the loneliness to the extent that he focuses on it, to quite an extent. And the loneliness seems like a crux for this really delicate transition and balance that he's striking between Hal and Kate Gompert. On page 695, I have a quote here to read. I honestly just liked this quote. It's a description of a film of Dr. Incandenza's called The American Century as Seen Through a Brick. And it says, the film's, quote, main and famous key image is of a piano string vibrating, a high D it looks like, vibrating and making a very sweet and adorned solo sound indeed, and then a little thumb comes into the frame, a blunt, moist, pale, and yet gingy thumb, which with disreputable stuff crusted in one of the nail corners, small and unlined, clearly an infantile thumb, and as it touches the piano string, the high, sweet sound immediately dies, and the silence that follows is excruciating. I really like this description, and I think partly it's to do with music and vibration, and that's so central to music, and I think this description of this frame really does emphasize that kind of silence following music, and how when it's intense enough, and when you're invested enough in the music, especially it seems like with this interesting visual, the audience is really invested in the sound. The silence, it is excruciating, it is disturbing sometimes to hear after something is just stopped. So the narrator at this point describes Hal as anhedonic, meaning detached, and Kate, he describes as, or the narrator, I don't know if it whose gender, but the narrator describes Kate as clinically depressed. So there's a difference here. Clinical depression is sort of the adult advanced stage of this anhedonism that Hal is experiencing. On page 697, yet another occurrence of the word phantods, quote, the man's case gave Kate Gompert the howling phantods, unquote. This is talking about a man. It's a little mini vignette in this thread, and it's a man who Kate saw at one of her recovery centers. He liked model trains, and he was in love still with his devout Catholic wife, and he was clinically depressed. He hit his head, apparently, and after that was just clinically depressed for years and years, and he kept a steady job, but he would come into the treatment center when he was having a really hard time, and he would go through essentially all extreme treatments to try to get better or to solve this. And his ultimate goal, really, his ultimate hope was anhedonism, basically the state that Hal is in. And so I think the narrator is looking at these extremes to show a sort of sliding factor or a sliding process between these types of mental illness. 698, we have a 14th of November, YDAU. This thread keeps coming back faster and faster, it seems like. We have this newbie at Ennett House named Ruth Van Cleve, I think. Yeah, Van Cleve. Ruth Van Cleve. And she is a pain in the butt for Kate Gompert, and she has this crazy hair, and she has a lot of features that are known for a certain kind of drug addict. This really stark figure, very skinny, very sunken cheeks, that kind of thing. I'm not going to talk about the substance at this point. Her story is that she left her baby in an alley, and the baby is still alive, but it's coming off of drugs in a slow process, and she gets the drug wrong. That we know that from the footnotes, and I find the whoever is writing or commenting in this particular footnote, I find it a really interesting thing that the person is almost neurotic enough to correct her usage of that particular drug. And then her baby daddy is also pretty sketchy. She's describing his work, and the readers, at least I as a reader, was going, this does not sound great at the moment. And so Kate and Ruth happen to be the interracial pair that poor Toni Kraus is preying on for their purses. And yeah, we'll talk about the race stuff now. So I feel like, and the race stuff comes up later with Joelle van Dyne, I just don't know how productive this description was of this interracial thing. Why did he use this descriptor? What is the use? What is the efficiency or effectiveness of this descriptor that he couldn't have used another, maybe more sensitive or maybe more, I don't know, almost curated statement for this? I just found it very, I found it almost incongruous with a lot of the narrative and I don't know if this is something that the narrator is thinking, like DFW is channeling the narrator's points about race or his observations about race or who he's looking at in terms of pointing out the interracial nature of this. But I don't know. I want to know more about you guys' comments. Again, for me, I'm white and Asian, okay? So it's really tricky for me to comment on this kind of racial relationship in the novel in particular, but if you guys have opinions on this, I especially want to know, especially this is a very relevant conversation for our time, so I don't want to skimp out on this very important word that he puts in the novel. And it's just one word, but I think it's really powerful and it shows a deficiency in some character, whether it's at the level of DFW, it's himself, or at the level of Incandenza, or the whomever the narrator is at this point, or at the level of maybe poor Toni Kraus or someone like this, maybe at the level of Maddie too. I think it is important. It does point out a lot of very insidious thoughts about race from whomever is talking. And I want to point out, I think race and politics should be completely detached here, right? We're talking about race just in terms of this novel, just in terms of this narrator. So I'm not making a political statement here, but I do think it did strike me as odd that this narrator would use this word over and over again to describe this pair, when I know that the narrator wanted to be vague about Ruth and Claire. It was a huge, or sorry, Ruth Van Cleve and Kate, Ruth and Kate, but I think there was a way for them to be sneaky about it without using the word interracial pair. Alright, so moving on here, page 700 to 701, there's a really cool tableau, similar to the one that we saw in last episode, where it's just a bunch of paragraphs that are separate, and they each have different subjects, and so it's just like a check-in. It's almost like a little bit of a check-in between all these characters, and so one is on Jim Trolch, and he's like doing something with drugs in his room. There's one with Michael Pamulis, and he's also doing something illicit in his room. I think these two in particular are in direct contrast to Hal, who is abstaining from recreational drugs at this point because I think of the shock of whatever punishment CT and the urologist were suggesting. I want to read this one on page 700. It's about Lyle. I love Lyle, as you guys know. He's my favorite character in Infinite Jest because he's so postmodern. He's so silly. He just adds this wonderful flair to the novel that I just think the novel would be duller without Lyle. So, quote, Lyle hovers cross-legged just a couple millimeters above the top of the towel dispenser in the unlit weight room, eyes rolled up white, lips barely moving and making no sound. I just think that's so funny. I don't know why, but Lyle is just, yeah, he's an interesting character. We know more and more about him as the book goes on, which I love again. We get a little vignette with Coach Stitt and Mario. They're going out for ice cream. It's very cute. Then we get this check-in with Avril and Candenza, and she is, seems like, investigating steeply. That's what it seems like to me, but her nerves are on edge because she has, quote, three or four cigarettes all going at once, or it seems like it. So yeah, it's a really interesting point in the novel at page 700 and 701. Again, the Incandenza quote I just read is on page 701. Getting back to the main thread here, back with Hal, Unwin, and Boone. Two girls at ETA join Hal in the viewing room. A little later, Longley and Bash, two more girls join, and then some younger boys, Postal Waite, as he's known, Balut and Idris all join, and they're watching a film of Dr. Eyes called Blood Sister. Again, the film is called Blood Sister, One Tough Nun. And again, Hal wants to be alone at this point, so this is not Hal's choosing, but suddenly he has seven other kids in the room with him. So they're watching this film. It has a really interesting plot, and I'm gonna summarize some of it for you here. So there's essentially this chain, this historical chain of sisters in the film, and so there's the like ultimate head mother, and she was a biker chick, totally drug addicted, and then reformed and went into the church, and when she did that, she sought out another biker chick who was into drugs and reformed her, and the chain goes on and on until we have the blood sister. So she's the third generation, the third clearest generation. So there's probably more nuns like going on in a chain forever and ever, but the ones that we're gonna deal with here, at least in this show, are the three. So there's like the grandmother nun, and then so she's like the head mother, then there's the vice head mother, who's the mother of the blood sister in terms of this religious chain that we have going on. So the blood sister finds her own like daughter sort of figure to take care of and reform to the church, And that's where we leave off at this point. We also find out here that Dr. Incandenza met Lyle at a remote spa in Canada, and I just found that so funny. I find Lyle to be so funny, and I always draw out these little tidbits about him for you guys because I think he just adds a lot, and I laugh every time he comes up in the narrative. Alright, back to the nuns. So, the nuns, there's a comment in the room about the nuns trading their dependency on drugs to dependency on religion and on reform. And it seems like this is a just putting words to what is happening with Gately, and I think Gately knows this. My evidence for Gately's knowing this is that he was talking about jail time earlier, and he was saying, well, I can't go to jail because they don't allow you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous every night. And so I think he is, in a sense, trading one dependency for another. But the difference, of course, is, you know, his choice. I think choice has a big part in this, where if you're a drug addict, of course there is some mild realm of choice in your decisions, but at the same time, Gately is choosing sobriety, and he chooses sobriety every day for himself, and that's a very definitive kind of decision that I think really does. He makes very consciously. It's not something that he has an impulse to do, but it's something that he has to do every single day, maybe moment to moment even sometimes. Joelle Van Dyne. Here she is. She pops up in the narrative. She likes Gately. This is clear at this point. She likes him romantically, and she is visiting him at the hospital, and she decides to partake in a meeting of Cocaine Addicts Anonymous. Cocaine Anonymous, I think. And there's a little bit of a comment about celibacy being important for the first year of recovery, because addicts and people with addictive tendencies like to just trade one pleasure for another, and it's important for them to get over their mess when they're going into sobriety before they start with a serious romantic relationship like that, where there are things like sex and pleasure involved. So Joelle Van Dyne, she's in conflict right now, and she wants to show her face to Gately, which is a very big character shift, I think, where she's suddenly her whole persona is shrouded in mystery. Her persona as Madame Psychosis and even as Joelle Van Dyne herself is just very mysterious, and we see gasps of her through Gately, at least thus far in the narrative. And so for her to take that step is pretty serious. But there's also a very clear moment here where she says, hey, I actually also I'm committing to recovery. So there's two sides to that. She's committing fully to recovery. She wants this, but also she also really wants to show her face to Gately. So there is a distinct conflict here in her character. Gately is in recovery. He's at the hospital, but the MDs are recommending him narcotics and drugs. And he's saying, no, I actually can't do that because I think he's afraid of relapsing or having other complications, and yeah, he does not want to even think about the possibility of taking drugs, and so he's in a lot of pain, and he has to go through a lot of the healing very naturally and by himself, and it seems like he's not in a great condition at this point. And then, yeah, another race issue here. So Joelle Van Dyne grew up in a place where there was racial conflict. Maybe she has some internal conflict about race. Apparently the person who is talking at a CA, who's on the stage, he's very real, he's very honest, and we'll tell his story in a second, but he is also Black. And so there's this moment of an issue here where Joelle Van Dyne has to get over it and really listen truly to his story, which is another thing that was just really interesting in this story of Joelle's narrative and her conflicts with these kind of things. I think this smaller conflict also comes up and just heightens all of the other conflicts she's having. So this individual, he was having a lot of financial issues because drugs are expensive, and he had a wife, and a pregnant wife, I should say, and a little girl. And it was this last straw sort of thing. He wasn't an everyday user, but he was using pretty heavily on weekends, and that was the source of their struggles. And there was a paycheck that was really important to the survival of their family, and he decides to just blow it. After taking the first hit or whatever, he just blows the rest of the paycheck and doesn't even. It was sort of the description that was in the novel was the picture of his wife and daughter became the size of a locket that he kept, rather than something that was in the forefront of his vision and his perception as it was when he was not using. And so he comes home after this night of abusing and he sees a biscuit tin and an empty peanut butter jar, and he realizes that that's all that his family had to eat in the evening and in the morning. And when he saw that, he just decided, I have to get straight, and he just left, and he has been sober for 7 months. And this is the moment where we see that shift in Joelle and the narrative as well. So the last couple sections here, we have the ending of Blood Sister, which is essentially that the mother of Blood Sister. So in this chain, I'm relating this to a family tree because I think it's much easier than using the names like Vice Mother or something like this. So Blood Sister's mother figure in the movie. She apparently relapsed and she's been selling drugs out of the church and someone in the chain notices, and they don't want to disrupt a chain, so they murder and stage the murder of Blood Sister's daughter figure. And so yeah, it's a whole bloodbath. There's a lot of problems. I recommend reading that section. It's pretty dense, but it's really weird. It's a really weird film. I feel like I would definitely see it if it was real. And the kids, the boys that come into the viewing room, they want to tell Hal about the tunnel, and Hal's going, okay, 1 second, and he's pretty caught up in his thoughts about his late father's films. Again, Kate, this is after the robbery, and so a recount of the robbery is later in this thread that we get, and Kate hits her head during the robbery on this pole, and she's so depressed and caught up in her internal state that she's just not functional at this point. She needed Ruth next to her, but Ruth chases after the purses and poor Tony Krause. So Ruth is away by now, and Kate is alone, and there's a homeless witness or someone who seems to Kate to be homeless, and he sort of puts his hand in front of her, and his hand is all disgusting and might have mold or something on it. It's pretty gross, and yeah, it's this very disorienting scene with Kate at the mercy of the world, it seems. I'm worried about curfew in particular for the both of them. On page 716, we have 14th of November, YDAU, another one of these scenes that I like so much. I like this thread. It's very interesting. Lens is higher than the clouds. He again has been discharged from Ennett, and he's following two Chinese women around. This one I do feel comfortable with commenting on personally. Look, I'm Korean. I've studied race relationships with Asian Americans in the US and Asians in the US for a long time because I saw it in my family. Yeah, the stereotypes about the Chinese woman that Lens has, they're not okay. These are definitely coming from Lens. It's very obvious to me that Lens has some pretty destructive stereotypes in his mind, and it's gonna make him, he's trying to steal their shopping bags. They have these big shopping bags. And he's gonna try to steal one of them because he hears that Asian women carry around all of their money that they have with them. This is gonna get him into some trouble, it's pretty clear. And interestingly, though, there's a parallel here with poor Tony Krause because Lens is also stealing bags and he's also following the ladies in what he thinks is a very stealthy manner. And so, yeah, I'm really interested. They're also both characters, Lens and Tony Krause, are dressed very strangely. Poor Tony Krause, as we know, has soiled himself more times than once. He has this feather boa and these heels, Lens is just wearing this outlandish disguise with a sombrero and these orange ski pants and a tux, like a long tux suit jacket kind of thing. And all of that Lens has stolen, by the way. Yeah, really interesting parallels between those two sections. And finally, a paragraph on the last page of the novel here that we're reading today, 719, about the wheelchair assassins and their strategies at this point when attacking the cartridge. And they basically have two options. So the first option is to go the Steeply route to interview everyone involved that's still alive with the cartridge. And second, to find the master copy, which is what they were trying to do with the Antetois brothers. And so it seems like, at least I think in this at this point in the novel, that they are going to start moving and going to the Steeply route, which means that more people are going to try to get at Hal and at the and at Oren. And I think some of that, to a certain extent, we've seen with these wheelchaired men, people following Oren around, which Oren hilariously thinks they're part of his fan club. Turns out it's a little bit of the opposite. So that is all for this episode. I hope you enjoyed. I've been pre-recording the DFW episodes recently because I have something to do for 2 weeks, and so here I am reading a lot of Infinite Jest. I'm actually enjoying reading more of it at once than reading these smaller sections, so I hope you enjoyed the episode. Comment down below if you have any comments, questions. It was a tough one today, and I really, really appreciate you guys hanging in there with me through this novel. I appreciate the support. It's been an awesome 7 months. Honestly, trying to read this novel. So thanks so much again. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and I'll see you on Monday. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.